The people who seem to get more done than everyone else, they're not working longer hours or running on more caffeine. They've just stopped wasting time on the stuff that doesn't move work forward. Switching apps, re-explaining context, hunting for files, those aren't small inefficiencies. They're hours wasted every week. Superhuman Go gives you those hours back. From the makers of Grammarly, Go is an AI chat that sits inside every tab and tool you already use. Always available and ready to help you with what you're working on. Ask it to draft something, summarize a long thread, pull up a file, or prep you for a meeting. Go handles it without you ever leaving the page you're on. This is what it looks like when AI actually fits into your work instead of adding to it. It's like having a teammate whose only job is to help you be better at yours. Go keeps up so you can move forward. With Go working with you, you can show off what you do best. See what Superhuman Go can do at superhuman.com. That's superhuman.com.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Today on the show, Poolbeg Pharma, and what US payers really think of the company's lead cancer immunotherapy program could be worth. Walking us through the research is Chris Grimes-Crompton, who is the partner at Acumentis Global, who led the work. Chris, great to have you with us.
Lovely to be here, Martin. Thanks for the invitation.
So, Chris, kick us off. Tell us about yourself, your work at Acumentis, and the research you led for Poolbeg.
Sure. I'm a partner in the firm. We specialize in supporting companies going through the same sort of journey that Poolbeg is on. So that early sort of journey, getting their development programs right, understanding the value of their assets, which really falls into two bits. It's either diligence process is either sort of acquisition or obviously the sales side, and supporting companies, predominantly in my case, biotech companies that are wanting to come into the launch space and expand and sort of go global with their assets. So this is kind of in the sweet spot of all of those, really, from my perspective. I come from a background in the pharma industry, so I spent a good 20-odd years in the pharma industry, and I joined a company a few years back to really grow an agency from the ground up, and that brings me here today. And I've been working with Poolbeg now for off and on for about a year and a half.
So for anyone new to the story then, Chris, what's the actual cost problem that CRS is creating today, and how big a barrier is it to wider use?
I think there's really two tracks to this story, Martin. I think the one is the cost element of it, and I think as we talk about through the discussion today, is the broader access perspective, and access to new innovative chemotherapy, or in this case, bispecific and CAR T therapies, which is being limited by CRS. In terms of the costs, the biggest burden that's associated with using CAR-Ts and bispecific antibodies is the need to be next to a specialist center when those are administered. So the reason for that is because patients, if they do experience an episode of CRS, you can't predict the severity of it until you're dealing with it, which means that you're going to have to be close to a high dependency unit. So if a patient does experience the highest grades of CRS, grade 4, they can be rushed into a high dependency and managed by specialist care in that sort of setting. Then that's obviously not cancer care. That's care of the patient that's undergoing the cytokine release syndrome. The other aspect, because of that, is the bottleneck that that creates in care, because patients that would be suitable for immunotherapies, and bearing in mind that they've started life sort of relatively late stage and sort of third line, but they're increasingly becoming second line, and hopefully, I would imagine one day would become first line therapies across a range of different cancers. And in that situation, the real challenge is the number of centers that can manage those patients. So that's not cost per se, that's more the patient's cost, if you like, of not being able to access treatment or having limited capacity, which is created by CRS. There are obviously the offsets as well, and we discuss both of those with US payers in this research, and both of those themes came out really quite clearly.
So how did the payers, and by that I mean the US insurers, plus Medicare, plus Medicaid, how did they respond when you put POLB001 in front of them?
In terms of the profile, they were very receptive to it. I think, again, if you follow those two sort of themes there, in terms of the cost offsets, clearly they as payers want to get away from those management costs. They are kind of built into care at the moment. So if you're going to go and use a regime, either bispecific or CAR T, you have to accept that there's going to be a proportion of patients which will experience CRS. So that's kind of an inbuilt cost. And one of the things that we did before we talked to the payers is just look at the costs of that as kind of a baseline. If you did nothing except exchange cost for, benefit with PLB001, then in that situation, what would be a like-for-like comparison? And that worked out quite favorably for the compound. Then you looked at I guess, the willingness, and that comes into that second track, willingness to accept a new treatment modality. And that really was quite high. So spontaneously, payers were willing to accept around the 20,000 benchmark. That's something which would be comparable with other sort of adjunct chemotherapies. But all the way up to sort of around 60,000 was something that they were willing to accept as an acceptable sort of price for that sort of management improvement. And I think when you put it to them, I mean, that we looked at the standard profile, which was used, the target product profile, which is the company have at the moment, and that was pretty good. That's sort of mid-60s. Obviously, as you get higher in terms of the ability to either completely mitigate CRS or improve or downgrade the seriousness of CRS, both of those are objectives which payers are very much open to and would certainly welcome.
So, was there a clear divide between commercial and government payers?
No, interestingly, in this particular instance, not at all. So we looked at a good cross section. We covered 7 million lives, and as you said in your introduction, we did look at government and insurer based. In both situations, the one thing that one of the key things that PLB001 would have going for it is that, first of all, it would be the first. And that if that was recognized in guidelines, basically all the payers said, well, if that is the case, we would obviously have to reimburse it. The question really was around whether there was a point from a pricing perspective where they would start to say, well, okay, maybe we want to try and streamline this, we want to try and risk stratify, all those kind of things. But generally speaking, there was no difference between those different insurance settings. It was very consistent across the board.
So one of the standout findings was a willingness, I suppose, to pay meaningful prices. And what was actually driving that across the different payer groups?
Again, it's coming back to those. I'm sorry to be boring, but obviously what they're trying to do is twofold. They are trying to mitigate any of those negative impacts from a patient experience point of view. Some of them, of course, are quite serious. CRS is not it's not a trivial complication of therapy. So they're trying to mitigate that, and because they want to be able to move patients out of that hospital setting, from a payer's point of view, that's got a lot of advantages. They're moving patients away from specialist care, which is, by the way, also another way of saying expensive care, into more sort of community-based, into more sort of, distant settings. And that's a trend that's already started. You could certainly see PLB001 accelerating that trend. And that's attractive, being able to do day case infusions, not having to have the same sort of follow-up And that proximity to the specialist centres means you can do things in a much more cost-efficient way whilst not having that higher risk.
So yeah, I was going to ask you because if PRB001 can shift cancer immunotherapy from specialist centres to the community bases or community hospitals, you see, is that the real prize for patients and for the system? Is that it's more locally sourced or available?
I think so. I think of all the things, I mean, the cost offset, as I said, I mean, that's almost baked in. I think the real advantage is that, as you're seeing bispecifics and CAR T increasing the breadth of the indications that they've got, they're increasingly moving up into, I mean, you've got a number now that are in second line treatments in certain settings. And I can well see over the next period of time that that's going to increase probably to first line in some situations, depending on the grade of cancer and when it's discovered. I can see that definitely happening. But of course, there is that limitation. And interestingly, we have this kind of idea that that because they're payers, they want to try and avoid paying for those higher cost treatments. But the reality is that the reason that they want to use them earlier is because they work. And actually, a cost-effective treatment usually is one that works earlier and works better. And in that situation, being able to offer those to patients at an earlier stage, but do it more close to their home, close to, not necessarily having to travel great distances for that treatment and stay over. It's those sort of costs which they mitigate. But it's really the, I think, the opportunity to open care to more patients. Which intuitively you might think payers were against, but absolutely they're not. They really are for better treatment earlier on, which cures or alleviates the cancers in more and more patients.
Well, that's actually one of the points I wanted to bring up with you is, why would payers actually care about solving CRS? And I suppose it's they're incentivized, as well by, is it purely the money they can save?
I don't think it really is. I think, money, again, it's one of those sort of expectations, isn't it, that all payers are worried about is the cost of things. And I don't think that that's really true. Payers are worried about the cost of things, but not in a vacuum. They don't want to overpay for treatments. But if a treatment is offering real value and is delivering something which is aligned with their goals and objectives, then they're perfectly open to that. And I think that's exactly what we saw in this research. They're basically saying, look, if this is something that can help to transform the way that we manage patients, and that's not going to break the bank, which is not, then why wouldn't we want to do that? We're going to get more patients going through. And of course, in the US, you do have to an extent that with that, with some of the providers, of course, they do want to be able to treat more patients. So, regardless of who's paying for it at the end of it, I think the overall gain, healthcare gain that you're getting from being able to manage more patients, is, I think, offsets any of those cost concerns. I mean, don't get me wrong. If this was priced, very, very high, then they would absolutely be looking at ways to mitigate that or to challenge that pricing assumption. So it's not like you've got a free ticket here, but there was definitely a very clear zone between probably $20,000 and $60,000 per treatment course, which they seemed reasonably happy with. Obviously, the bigger the number you go, the less happiness there is. But certainly, there was. I think that's a reasonable range. And if you look at sort of other sort of similar. Sort of adjunct chemotherapies, that's not really out of this world at all. That's probably quite reasonable given the sort of the overall cost that, if you have bispecifics and CAR Ts, these are not inexpensive treatments in and of themselves. They're actually quite expensive, but they also are really good and they work.
So I suppose finally then, Chris, I suppose the bottom line, here's the big question. You've worked very closely with these payers. The feedback that you received from them, did that support this sort of multi-billion dollar peak sales potential Poolbeg has been talking about? That's the big question.
Yeah, well, when you answer these questions, and I think when I was sort of formulating the consolidation of the feedback, you're always a little bit mindful of going over the top. So, I mean, but actually, again, I mentioned when we started talking that we always try and be a little bit conservative on these things so that you're not over-egging it. The way that we looked at this was just to look at two indications, multiple myeloma and DLBCL. That, by the way, isn't by no means the full gamut of indications that bispecifics and CAR Ts are indicated for. But those are some of the biggest. And we looked at that and the number of patients. We looked at the line of therapy. And again, we're looking only predominantly in this sort of situation at the US. And you just extrapolate those numbers and say, okay, well, if you're using an adjunct therapy in 80% of those patients, what does that do? So we'll be completely transparent. The modeling here was not anything that you would consider to be complicated. It was pretty quite simplistic. But actually, even on that basis, it gets you to fairly big numbers pretty quickly. So if you go to the full range of indications and potentials, if PLB001 hits its target profile and is in a market where it's ahead of competition, I see no reason why that couldn't be a very reasonable and attainable sort of multi-billion dollar sort of product. Grown over time. And we looked at growth analogs of other sort of similar things, and again, didn't over egg the pudding on this. We went fairly conservative, but it gets you to that sort of number really quite quickly within just a couple of years.
Oh, well, I'm sure investors will be delighted to hear you say that, Chris. Really illuminating. Thank you for your time. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Super. Thank you, Martin. You too.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.